You're a uni student. You're selling tickets. What's the most that you made in a night?
If you're a uni student selling tickets, you can make like $2,000 or $3,000. And like, if you you become the go-to person for tickets in that halls, then everyone's texting you. You put your number on a group, like, and they'll hit you up every weekend for tickets for a show.
Yeah,
it's regular income, definitely.
That's meant. And wait, bro, we're about to help some uni students. So, hi guys, the episode you're about to watch is bloody insane. It's with Ben. He's the head of marketing and events at Cirque du Soleil. They also put on the El Dorado Festival. And we spoke about everything to do with the music industry. We spoke about riders. We spoke about common misconceptions within the music industry. We spoke about some of the insane rules that you would never have guessed, such as the fact that you can't book two guests on the same date. There are some guests who you can't book within a 6-month time period, within a 30-mile radius. There's so many things that go into putting on a successful event that you would never have guessed. If this sounds like it'd be interesting to you, make sure to tune in and let us know your thoughts. And if you do like it, like, subscribe, share. You know the drill, and let us know. Okay, to the show. Hi guys, welcome to another episode of What My Best Friend Does, where we talk about what your best friends do so you don't have to. Today, I'm joined by the head of marketing and events for Cirque du Soleil, not to be confused with Cirque du Soleil. Ben, how you doing, my bro?
I'm good, man. Yeah, busy, but good.
good. Welcome to the show. I like to start with taking it all the way back. When you were younger, what did you want to be, bro?
What did I want to be? I wanted to probably a singer. I was in loads of choirs when I was younger.
Oh yeah, you could hit them notes.
Yeah.
I ain't gonna make you do it. Nice.
I was in the Roundhouse choir when I was way younger, and then another one. Probably a singer. I wanted to be like in front on stage, but in front of the camera. Whereas I think now I'm like want to be behind it. But yeah.
Okay.
So always interested in music.
All right. So you wanted to you wanted to be a singer. You've always been interested in music. Can you like talk me through your journey to this point? How have you come to become head of marketing and events?
Yeah, when I was in secondary school, I did like a internship in a recording studio. Where was it? On Lonsdale Road, but just like in Kilburn. And I worked part-time with SPTV, but also through the actual studio itself, where they did like everyone from like Take That. My cousin was in a boy band back then.
Oh, wow.
So that's how it sort of started. So just sort of literally like I run around, literally getting like teas and coffees for everyone while they're filming.
So just to take it back, like I know you mentioned the fact that, you know, you did a little bit of singing. Where do you think, like, has music just always been in kind of your blood? You've always been passionate about it.
Yeah, I think like creative, as in like maybe not so much music, but like film and stuff has always been in, like my granddad was a film director, my mum was a film editor.
Oh wow!
And then my cousins, both DJs, but one was like a singer as well. So yeah, just always been in, like sort of
in and
on
around
stage
it.
Or in wanting to like jump around and dance and sing. But yeah, so always in some aspect.
Okay, so you did a little bit of work at SBTV and other places, and then what next?
Then went to Manchester for uni after school to do politics, which is a bit different.
Wait, so we do music. I'm going to be a politician. What, a singing politician?
Well, I did a bit, like my, although it was a degree in politics, I focused it all on, like my dissertation was on how I did it, focusing on grime music and how it can be used as a form of political protest, so creating communities within which you can sort of create organic engagement into sort of engagement that aren't generically or like normally involved in politics, and wanting to get involved, sort of providing a space where they can do that. Okay. So I interviewed like big rappers like Skepta and did some more stuff with SBTV there and like Link Up and all these big companies. So it was always, although I did politics because I also did love that, I never wanted to be a politician. It was always just, I think,
the budget.
More like the social side of politics, like the sociology side of it, I guess, like how it sort of interlinks with society. And then as I got into that final year, I think I realised that it was music that I wanted to get into.
Okay. So you realised that you wanted to go down the music path. Where did, what happens, yeah, post-uni?
So it was during uni that I got into Cirque, actually. On my, okay. On my first, during my freshers week. So my cousin's one of the guys that founded it. And they came to Manchester to a club called Hidden.
Okay.
With Mike Skinner from The Streets, was doing like a DJ set with them.
Oh, sick.
And it was like the first day of my freshers week. And they were like, the way we used to do it was, we'd just take a tour bus and do like, students used to go out like every day of the week. They don't so much now, which we can touch on later. But we'd do like 7 cities in 7 nights, even down to like Sunday in some cities, which is mental. But they were there on the Tuesday or Wednesday. Yeah, early week. And after the event at 4 a.m, they were like, do you want to just go get your bag and come on the tour? So I got a taxi back to Halls, threw everything in my bag. I just got on the bus and went on tour.
Oh, wow.
And that was like my first insight, which is pretty mental. I was like, went from like freshers events to like, that was sold out like 2,000-3,000 cap venues in every city.
Wow.
That was like that real peak of it. So it was, yeah, so that was how I got into it. I just loved it.
How were you managing that alongside your degree? That's what that
was the tough bit. I don't know. I just found the balance. Like, it was always, because they were all student events then, it was in like cycles. So they'd do Freshers Week.
Mm.
They'd take a big break. They'd do Halloween. They'd take a break. Then they'd do like refreshers and then a summer tour. Mm-hmm. So that kind of allowed me, because those are the periods when you're going out anyway at uni, because they were targeting me as an audience. Yeah. So when I was meant to be going out, I was going out. And when I was meant to be studying, they weren't in the city. So it kind of worked well. Yeah, I don't know. I probably could have worked hard. I got first, so I still did well.
Okay. Yeah, in but politics as well.
Yeah, yeah. I still did well. I did a year abroad in Amsterdam as well, which really got me into clubbing in my second year. I went to Amsterdam for university, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Do
you know I only just learned about the blue light?
Oh, what?
I always did about the red. This week I was talking about the blue light. I was like, the fuck the blue light?
No, it's weird having to go through. I had to like walk through the red light district to get to uni in the morning.
So did
it's
you?
Like, it's weird seeing the other side of Amsterdam, which is that I learned to like hate English tourists and
of course because
just like hi people in like all the like utes in tracksuits just sort of getting in the way of your bicycle. But I went to uni. I went did second year there and then or like a half the year and then came back to Manchester.
Okay.
Graduated from Manchester in 2018 and then just came back to London, basically.
Okay, sick. And when you were working with Cirque, like whilst you were studying, I'm assuming you weren't head of marketing events at that time. So what was it you were doing?
It was literally just like stagehands. So I'd I'd get like riders for headliners. So I had to find like tequila drinks, because there's always weird requests you get on. That's quite a fun thing to discuss. But yeah, you get like really strange requests on riders back in the day. It's a bit more generic now.
Talk me through some of the ones you got back in the day, bro.
Here's some fun. They had Fat Man Scoop Loads in like 2016.
Yeah.
He'd have like stuff that he wanted and stuff that he put on there just because it made him look better. Anyone ever found his rider. So he'd have like a Caesar salad and like a new brand new t-shirt. What is the thing? He didn't. And then he'd have Tangfastics and like Pringles and all the alcohol. And we had like 6 or 7 shows. Every single show, the Caesar salad is like untouched and everything else is gone. So it's just like, it's part of his like, to try and keep his image. You do get people asking for drugs on riders, which is sort of not allowed to. So they do it in like disguised ways. I never get it for them. I don't know why people do, but yeah.
Say no to drugs.
Yeah, but they do, they'll like put like, yeah, they put like code words and stuff, which is, yeah. But it's often just weird alcohols they want, which you can't find in like, obviously 1942 is a big one, which is like the tequila, but trying to get that in like some cities like Nottingham is like, you've really got to go to like the specialist shops to find it. So that was my first job as like a stagehand. And then during the show, I do stuff like, I still do it now to be honest, but like confetti cannons, because we're all about like immersive experiences,
mm-hmm.
helping the costume people get into their like, they're on stilts in like 7 or 8 foot, like massive sort of ostrich costumes or there's loads of like that sort of weird aspect of it. So it's just like, because it's such a small team and it's all like friend, they're all like friends that started it. We kind of all just dip in at that stage to every single aspect of it, because it was just like they were all like living the moment. I think at that stage, it wasn't really a job for them.
Mm-hmm. That's sick. I feel like I want to dive back into the rider, but that makes sense. Why would people's riders get leaked? Like you said, oh, he has.
There are like funny pages on it. They do it now. There is Instagram pages now where people ask for really weird stuff now. Like
what? Just to make to give like an image, a perception of oh, I'm cool.
Yeah, yeah. Some will be like, yeah. Some will try really hard not to be. To be cool and like really, they'll just want lager. They won't even put water one, which is great because I can get whatever. But then there'll be ones, they'll want a specific type of red wine. Like big, really funny. I can't say names, but big like drum and bass artists want a specific like red wine, which is really funny. But and then stuff like scratch cards is always on there now, which I don't think should be my job to pay for your, yeah, they'll be like, I want £20 worth of scratch cards to every show. And these are guys that are doing 5 shows a week every single week, so they must win sometimes.
And bro, like, if, let's say they scratch and they win, are you getting a little cut? No, you getting a little bringing?
No, I reckon, yeah, but they, yeah, it's mainly meant to be alcohol, but people ask for like football jerseys from the city they're playing in if they're a big artist.
That's mad.
Yeah.
And like, if you're not able to source some stuff, like you mentioned some
you
of the can, alcohol.
You got to ring the manager and let them know. They're normally fine with it because of the fact that the artists that ask for all the crazy stuff are guys that are doing 6 shows a week. So they don't need 15 bottles of tequila every week. They just want it. They often don't drink. They'll just drink water on stage. Their manager will load it all up into a van and just take it home.
Really?
So they'll have it all stored at home. Yeah.
Madness. And and when you're... putting the rider together, is it inclusive of the fee? Is it like fee minus rider, or is it on top?
On top. Some like Chasing Status's rider is about $2,500 on top of there.
My goodness.
But there are people that do cool stuff. Like Shy FX doesn't drink. He sometimes has like a rum and ginger beer at a show, but he has a massive rider. But what he does is he runs a stage at Notting Hill Carnival.
Mm-hmm.
And so he takes all his rider, collects it throughout the year. He'll bring all the alcohol to Notting Hill Carnival and give it out in the crowd.
Damn.
Which is sick. That's why he's a legend. But
I need to go to Shy FX stage at Carnival. You're going to see me there.
Yeah, Grey Goose and bottles of Hennessy everywhere. Yeah. So he's like, he does it for the right reasons. But there are people that just sort of just take it home and probably maybe have a drinking problem at home. But, seeing a lot. It's way cheaper now. Everyone's teetotal posts. COVID, everyone's like healthy.
Really?
They're not drinking. All the like old school, the bigger bit, like in their like 30s, 40s, they all go teetotal. So
why?
The rider's way cheaper. So.
Is it because what they thought that there was alcohol linked to Corona or what?
No, I think you just can't. As you get old, you can't be doing what they're doing and drinking every day. It's not. Yeah. You won't survive very long.
Yeah. I hear that. All right. So we've spoken about the rider. We've spoken about you kind of working and studying. Congrats on the first, by the way. And then we get to post uni. You come to London, you start working at Cirque proper.
Yeah, still part. I did some like traveling as everyone does after uni.
Not everyone. I'm trying to be inclusive on this show.
But like that summer, I went away and did some traveling. And then I dipped into a few other sort of companies, still within events, but there was a few. There's one called Foreverland I used to work at part time.
Doing?
Same sort of role.
Okay.
Like mainly sales for it.
Okay.
But they sort of, I specialised on like their, they did like weekenders to like international shows. So they'd go to like Barcelona and take it over for 3 days, rent all the nightclubs. You do like hotel deals. So like packages basically for these students to come out.
Mm-hmm.
But they were actually a bit older, not students, like 21 to 25 was their age range. So, yeah. And then I started, yeah, then I got into working here sort of during COVID basically.
All right, that brings us to Cirque du Soleil. How would you describe the brand? I know you kind of touched upon it before, and what it is you guys do and offer.
We are the bio that I give when we is we're the UK's leading independent touring nightclub basically. So we do 16 cities across the UK, 4 tours a year. About 65 to 70 shows a year.
Wow. That's more than one a week.
Yeah, pretty mental. Yeah.
Crazy.
Because of it, they're like in these intense periods, so we'll have a lot of double ups. So the last 3 weeks, I've had double ups every single. So, and they're never.
And the double up is a Friday, Saturday,
yeah,
right?
And yeah, and they never make sense in terms of being near each other. Like I did Leeds to Brighton 2 weeks ago, right, which is literally the whole length of the country.
Yeah.
As I said, we've got Newcastle tonight, so that's all the way up. Next week's Bristol. So yeah, sort of. I'd say the leading, but our sort of USP, if you like, which is we're kind of adapting it now because of the fact that lots of people have started doing it. Is our USP was it's all about like immersive. We spend about as much on decor. We own all this decor now. We have a big sort of warehouse. We spend as much on decor as we do on headliners.
Wow.
So it costs us like $6,000-$7,000 just to get the show up in the air. It's in like, oh, so we got paid for 6-7 people to put it up, take it down. That means hotels, travel. We own a van. They go to the shows. They get safety certificates for all the like fire certificates, stage hands for confetti cannons, and we get the actors and like walk around actors and magicians. It's all like very immersive, and it just makes us stand out from like every other big night, especially in London. But it's headliner focused. There's lights and there's a headliner, but the bits that people will remember on a night out are not, they are those bits, but if there's a magician walking around that does some mental trick on them,
they'll remember.
That's the bit they're going to tell their mates about, and that's what's going to make them come back.
Yeah.
So we try and like really keep on top of it and add new aspects in. As we've had stuff like, we had a hooker duck at a show once, so like a, let's say like a fun fair ride in one of the rooms. People came and there's bouncy castle. Yeah, with all the weird stuff, basically. The most, more immersive we can make it, the better the experience is.
And one thing I want to say is, when you described hooker duck making it immersive, I think a phrase I've heard used before is moments within moments.
Yeah.
When you create moments within moments, that's what keeps people coming
back.
The thing I wanted to ask on that, when you're thinking about these immersive experiences and what you're going to bring to each of the tours, what does that process look like? Is it just like you're on a whiteboard? Is it, where'd you get your inspiration from?
We've now kind of sort of shrunk it down to four main tours. So we do the freshest one, which is the circus one, which is kind of what the name is after. That was the initial tour because we own all the decor for that. But we change stuff like our, we have like an agency that sort of provide all the like dancers and performers. So they'll send through every year, like, we've made these new costumes for this tour. What do you think? And we'll pick as a team. Like, that's crazy, I don't want that, or that works. So they'll my cousin heads up that side of it, the production and music. So he'll pick out what he thinks will work and what won't, and also what works in what cities. Some shows have massive, like, we can put trapeze artists on, they've got like sort of rigging points on the stage. Other ones are more like underground nightclubs, so we don't have a stage, it's just a booth. So then we need to get people on stilts in the crowd. So it all depends on the venue. So we need to do venue visits before we do shows there.
Of course.
And work out what works in each city. We plan out. So we have like a circus one. We've got a space one. We've got an El Dorado one, which is a festival, which we'll touch on. But that's kind of like jungle themed, sort of Lost Ruins is the name. And then we do like a winter one as well. And we also do day parties in the summer, but those are normally just, we don't put decor into those.
Just have it.
It's just sunshine. Yeah,
That's so sick, man. And where do I want to go from there? Like, you've mentioned the fact that you've got to go and you've got to see every venue. Like, talk to me about like capacity and how it varies from show to show. What's kind of the smallest you're putting on shows for to the
so low? Because of the decor costs, we can't really do below sort of 750, 1,000.
Okay.
It just doesn't, not cost effective. Because even if you've got to, just to get the, we've got such sort of large overheads that we have to sort of keep the shows regular.
To break even.
Yeah, to break even. And also just to, like, if we don't do a show for 2 months, we're still paying for the storage unit and the van sort of insurance and MOT, all these sort of other costs. So we keep the shows regular. But yes, above 750. And we go up to like 4,000, 4,500 is the biggest.
My goodness.
Those ones are mental. So we do Brighton, but it's 750. That's the smallest. Other than that, it's all like 1,500 plus. Because otherwise, it doesn't really make sense.
And if we actually like touch upon some of the shows themselves, what is it like working? I mean, I think about DJs and nightlife. Some people can, it sounds like the best job in the world, right? But it can come at a cost, right? Like hearing, antisocial hours. What has been like your experience working shows?
Hearing's a really good one. Tinnitus is a massive issue in the nightlife scene at the moment.
So what is tinnitus? Sorry.
It's from excessive sort of loud, hearing music too loud basically over long periods of time. I don't have it luckily because I'm like really careful with my sort of ear protection, but you just get a constant ringing in your ears, like day to day, and like it gets worse with stuff like coffee Okay. If you have a coffee, but also like it just means you can't, you've got a constant ring in your ears basically. It affects sleep, all sorts. There's now like a national tinnitus week or something, because it's not just from music, it's like people get it from any sort of, even listening to music too loud when you're going like in your earphones constantly, it can happen.
Is it?
So like earplugs are a massive thing, like, but really well. Mine are like monitored to know what kind of nightclubs I go into so that it still comes through. They cost like 150 quid. They're quite expensive, but they're like my, if I forget them, I go back home. I'll be late to get them because I'm literally stood in front of the main sound system constantly. So,
and can you still hear people talking to you?
Yeah. So these are like really well molded special ones. They ask you what shows you do, who you work with, what kind of sound, like if you're listening to drum and bass music as opposed to house, it's different sort of frequencies. So they're like monitored to specific shows. So they're like, yeah, but
What's the name of the company? Actually, don't say it, because unless you pay for sponsorship, you ain't getting jack from me. No, I'm joking. We'll link it in the show notes.
There's not like one specific company. There's quite a few that sort of
do the same thing. Okay.
But yeah, so that's a big thing. The hours thing is a tough one. There's ways to like counter it that we sort of work. Like I don't normally work Fridays.
Yeah.
I get that off, but only because I'm working Friday nights or Saturdays. But yeah, the hours are like, I normally don't drink at shows now. I've cut it out completely, just because the next morning, it ruins your whole weekend. Yeah. Whereas, so if it's a big one, I'll go out and do it properly. But also I need to be on call for sort of, if anything goes wrong, and I can't be like intoxicated if that happens. I probably used to be, and I think we all did, but the way that it's sort of changed now and evolved, you need to be a bit more on it. So we try and be a bit more sensible at shows.
Yeah.
But that helps with the sort of the hours thing, but it is tough adjusting. When you're in like the touring period, the hours are like, it's normally 7 day weeks for like a month and a half, which is just like, but it's like I work, because we work 9 to 5 hours normally as well, and then on top of that we do the shows, which is, so some days it's like, yeah, coming at 9 a.m. and I'm done at 7 a.m. so it's like
that's mental.
Yeah, on the
and then
busy
back
days.
In the next day, or you probably have the
normally
next
we take the next the next morning off, but okay.
I suppose where I'm going with that, to anybody who's thinking to like get into events, like what would your advice be to them to like, done it for a few years,
It's amazing. I wouldn't change it for the world. Like I hear my friends talk about their like 9 to 5 jobs, and I'm like, I don't, like when I'm in the office on 9 to 5, I'm not sitting behind a desk sat, I spend like an hour looking at like clown costumes or something stupid like that. It's like, it's weird, or picking which headliner I want to get, or chatting to sort of brands about activations and all this sort of, it's really fun stuff. And the office that I work in is an amazing space. It's just down the road, but it's like it's not just us we work with. There's UKF in there, which is a big drum and bass label. Warm Street, who are the guys that sort of are the brand part. They do all the brand activations for like Magnum and Ray and Nephew. So they do all the
Ray and Nephew.
Exactly, yeah.
I don't know there's what that was.
There's bottles of that all around the office. And they do all the floats at Carnival.
Yeah.
It's a really fun space to work. And the people that are in there and the things that happen are like, it's just a really fun place to work. And I don't think you get that in other sectors as much as ours. And I get to go like to amazing talks and lectures and seminars. There was one at Coco last week which is part of the AVA festival. And I had like Brian Eno doing a talk about, which is like all these huge people doing talks.
Why is it you go to these talks?
Because they're all about music, but they're like, it's about how TikTok is changing the landscape of sort of the events industry. They've got people like Grace LaDoja, who's Skepta's, the woman that discovered Skepta, doing a talk on how to be an artist manager and what to look for in an artist and how to be authentic when you're doing it and what works. And I was like, well, she knows what works because she's got one of the biggest artists in the country.
Yeah.
And how to build a brand. So it's like constant learning and evolving, and the landscape changes constantly as well. So yeah, I would say get into it, because there's so many, you can be doing what I do, like the back end of it, artist liaison, stage management, putting on the events, but there are so many jobs within this job that like down to like music publishing is in our office as well. Streaming services, artist management, as I said, sort of brand management. Yeah, it's a really fun, exciting thing. And you can kind of, unlike other jobs, it might be you get pigeonholed. In this one, you can really switch. So I'm now moving a bit into artist management is what I want to go into, and venue management. But you can really switch between different aspects of the job and your sort of skill set and what you're learning. It's a massive,
So a couple of things I want to dive into based on what you just said there. You kind of touched upon it, but yeah, talk me through like a typical day and week.
It's tough to say because they are like, it varies so much. But if I, let's pick like this week because it's like an average one. So if we pick like yesterday, if we're on a tour cycle, the first thing I'll do is come in and basically do a ticket count, which is just checking in with all the venues and with our ticket supplier to see where each show is at. We work on big spreadsheets, so we know where we need to be at percentage wise in terms of sales at which stages for the shows to be getting to sell out. And then that means we're then looking, if a show isn't going to get to where we need to be looking at what we can cut and what we can move around to save costs.
So if a show isn't going to hit,
we'll look at pulling out certain aspects, because our decor, we can do stuff like, right, let's get two confetti cannons, not four, because then we don't need to get 8 bottles of CO2 and that will save us £600.
I get that. But as you say that, my thought is like, oh, maybe you can do like another release where the tickets are cheaper. So you'll never make the tickets cheaper. You'll actually pull away from the other side.
We'll do stuff that's like behind the scenes. So if we need to shift tickets, I'll do it for cheaper. I'll do it through like my rep network or through the DJs themselves, or through, we've got partnerships with like the societies at uni. So like the medical society, we might be like, right, we need to get 100 tickets gone. These are cheaper than general sale, go and sell them. But generally front facing, it's like, it's never a good look to go 100%. Cheaper, because I'm looking to go to a night and there's suddenly cheaper tickets, I'll be like, right, the way to go is always to publicly face. If I need to do that, what I'll do is I'll keep the release at the same price, but I'll just change the name to like final release. So people are like, okay, cool, let me buy. There's all these little tactics that I've learned over the years. It's cutting stuff behind the scenes. But then also the other way around, if we know a show's going to sell out, we're like, right, now what can we do to make this better? Because the way we look at shows is always show to show. As in, we're never taking money from a big selling show to help a little one. I don't want to do that because it takes away from the value of the individual show. Mm-hmm. So we do it show to show. So we've got Bristol next week, which is about to sell out, and that's 2,500 or something. Oh, wow. So I'm now like, right, I want to live stream the main room set. So let's spend like a grand on getting a whole team in that are going to rig up cameras and 360. Let's make the booth 360. Let's film it all and put it on YouTube. And let's get more performers in. What can I do to make it better now I've got the money to play with?
That's
it. So it's a whole sliding scale and it works both ways.
And just on that, like, okay, let's say you do the live stream, you put it on YouTube, like, how do you measure success of these things that you're doing to kind of push the boat out at these events?
Now it literally comes down to like a clip will just go, if a clip goes viral. There are whole live streams that do well, but there's also issues with like copyright on certain tracks, getting flagged. But if you can get that one sort of viral clip that does well,
that
and does
lead
numbers
to sales for tickets for future events. Yeah.
When I used to work at Foreverland years ago, I posted a clip of like, we had some artists playing and I took the audio from one of their songs and put it on a clip of this kid in like China dancing. He's like a baby. He's like 2 or 3. I put it on, this was like during, just before COVID, I put it on Facebook and it went viral in like Asia and parts of Europe as well. It got something like 52 million likes, likes, but I don't get anything. I'm not getting any money out of that because it's not our video, it's not our content. But the amount of traction that gave the page that followed up. Annoyingly, it was in like Asia, so they're not coming clubbing in London. But it's just weird because you just put one little click and you've got like a, it goes viral and that's
awareness.
Yeah, like awareness. Brand awareness is a big thing. But also you've got to be really conscious of what you're putting out, because if it's something that's not related to your brand and that's what people know you for, then that's not good. So it's more for promotion of the next tour that we do the videos.
That makes sense.
If I know this show is going to be sold out and it's going to be mental and it's going to look amazing, I want to film it because then I can promote the next tour with it.
Yeah.
And I can send those clips to the headliners and they'll post it They've got really good relationships now with lots of artists, because on the we do the student circuit, we're the ones that bring in the artists when they're not very big. Mm-hmm. So we've really got to have an eye on who's up and coming and who's going to break.
So does that require you going to like not so big?
Yeah, gigs? We have like network in each city. I'll have like my people that sort of check in on. They'll look at who's playing at the smaller clubs. I talk to people. I've got friends that are agents. I talk to people that are. I've got friends that are artists that are like, when they break through and I can tell who's going to be big. So we had Eliza Rose way before. I mean, I know Eliza from school, but we had her way before the tune came out, the number one. So, and I like networking people that have now like, I've sort of, because I was a multi-room and multi-genre, I've put people in rooms together that have now ended up doing like albums together and big songs.
That's sick.
And doing really well. And it's sick to see, like Barry Constant that I went to see last night at the Roundhouse. I had him in Brighton playing to like 500 people. And he just sold out the Roundhouse last night in like a week or something, which is like huge. Yeah, there's some of the artists that we've worked with that are now like huge. And I think it's just the student circuit that you do is really important in terms of a DJ.
It's almost like the feeder.
Big. Yeah.
Like the feeder for the bigger events.
Yeah, and we can tell them what cities they're big in and what don't. Like we book artists that are big in, we know what cities people are big in and they aren't. It's tough for them to hear sometimes when we're like, we don't want you in that city because we know it won't sell.
How do you know that?
Just because I know what genre, like there's certain cities where different genres are bigger.
Is it?
Like Bristol is a drum and bass city. You can still do house events, but it's like the home of drum and bass music.
Okay.
If you put a Shy FX or a Hybrid Minds on, it will sell out instantly. Whereas you can put a way bigger house act on and it will really struggle. Mm. Whereas if I take that house act to Newcastle, they're like Essex-y sort of London house head crowds.
Yeah.
That will sell out instantly. But if I bring Shy FX is different. He does it in there as well. But if I bring an act that will sell out in that city, it won't work in. It's just knowing your markets. I put feeders out to like, I have like my networks of reps and students. So when I get sent an act, I'll be like, I'll put it in a group chat and be like, who knows this act? Will it sell? Would your friends be interested? How much reckon they pay? So I before we put anything into motion, we're shooting names out to every city trying to work out what works in each sort of individual Sick. Little network.
Sick. So it sounds like you're testing it, right?
Yeah.
To make sure that there's appetite, and then if the appetite's there,
yeah, you like put a little bit out. And
yeah.
Then...
That's sick. That way you save yourself, right?
And yeah, yeah.
Like on that note, like, are there times where it doesn't work out?
Oh yeah, yeah.
And like, what happens when it doesn't work out? Like,
you've just got to be bluntly. Normally, the thing with agents is they can be quite difficult, and if it's near enough the show, they'll be like, we want the full fee anyway. Well, even if you're cancelling the show, we still want our full money. Sometimes you can move it to another city, which is helpful. But no, definitely, we've had acts where we've been like, this is going to be amazing. We put it on sale, and it's just like, no.
Damp
no one cares. And once it's out, there's nothing you can do, because as soon as you launch, you have to pay the act the full fee when it goes public. Yeah.
Really?
So that's why it's quite tough. Yeah, you've already paid for the venue.
Is it just the main act you have to pay?
Yeah, just the headliner. All the supports you normally pay after the event, but okay. It's a way of them protecting themselves against stuff like that if a show cancels, because they only want to play in certain cities like a few times a year for rep. It's never a good look to play more than once in a city like a few months.
Okay.
Because your value just goes down. Like, people want to see you, they don't want to see you twice.
Unless you've got a residence.
Unless you've got a residence, and that's different. Because that's normally, they give you a residence if you've got enough of a buzz that you can sell out multiple days, or if you're offering something different each week. Like some people, like Ewan McVicar in Newcastle, had one recently. He did like a trancey, one was trance, one's a house week. So every week had a different aspect, and it made people come back. And then you've got Ibiza and stuff, which is obviously different.
Exactly.
Vegas and Ibiza residencies are just because it's never the same group of people every week.
Exactly.
People fly in and fly out. So that's a bit different. But yeah, it definitely does happen. The artists flop.
Okay, so I'm taking it back, because just as we've spoken about everything, it sounds like you do so much. And I know that you said earlier that there's so many different jobs that you can kind of get into.
Yeah.
For anybody who's potentially listening to this and wants to break into like the music, the events industry, what would your advice be to them?
Do what I do. You've just got to do the jobs that no one wants to do. You've got to... The real big ones that we always say is like scanning tickets on doors is a big one. You still get paid for it, but the people you meet through that, you'll meet the venue owner, you'll meet the brand owner, you'll meet every DJ because they're all coming through that door. Artist liaison's a really good one. A lot of people that get into music go through that.
What does artist liaison involve?
It means sorting out the like riders and stuff, as I said, booking the artist hotels, collecting them from the hotel, taking them for dinner.
You get that FaceTime.
Yeah. Taking them for dinner, sorting their taxis to and from the venue. When they're in the venue, just making sure they're happy, they're all chill, they're ready for their set. Taking them to stage, taking them off stage. You get a really personal insight into what it's like being an artist, because it's like the unglamorized side of it. You see that when they're... Because artists do get stressed. Like Fat Man Scoop, when we had him years ago, before he'd go on stage, he'd be like, I need you to like roll me up, get my energy going. And you don't see that bit where they're like backstage, stressed, nervous, anxious, yeah. nervous. But you see the face when they go out the front. So that gives you a really good insight into that sort of side of it. So do those jobs that people probably don't want to do that aren't, it's just, they're so, so valuable.
With Ticket Scanner and Artist Liaison, would you say they're easy jobs to get? Because yeah. I feel like, so it's not very, well, there's a lot of them,
it's definitely easy to get. Like Ticket Scanning ones, most venues that hire Ticket Scanners, it will be on like, what's that Facebook group called? The one in London where you find like odd jobs and stuff. It'll be stuff like that where people literally write, tonight I need 5 Ticket Scanners to work at Printworks. Okay. All you need is a fully charged phone and we'll pay you cash in hand.
Really?
Yeah, so they'll go and do that. Artist liaisons a bit, some venues have in-house people, but also that's the kind of job you can find. You need to be a bit more, they don't want anyone, like you probably won't be doing artist liaison at Printworks from the get-go because you might be like some weird super fan that wants to go, you know who's playing and you want to like get backstage.
Are these jobs like, are they freelance?
Mainly freelance sort of work. A lot of people when they start out as DJs or like promoters, what we do, they'll do these as the sort of side hustles to get their cash up and get their way into venues. So you might meet a venue manager working on the door that then means you can be like, could we come and like host room 2 at the next in-house party? And then he'll be like, yeah. And it's all about networking in this sector, from like agents to venue managers to other promoters to like the front of house. I try and like meet as many people like as I can from every different aspect of it, so I have a good range of the field.
Yeah, and like on that as well, like what do you think it takes to be successful? And the reason I ask that is because, you know, I always thought, people always said, oh, you should have like sold tickets at uni and stuff.
Yeah.
But really and truly, like, I don't know if I was cut out for it, because sometimes like, I feel like there's like, you have to have like a bit of a self-assurance. And yeah. I know back in the day, like when I posted on Facebook and stuff, you didn't want to be that guy who was spamming Facebook. Do you know what I mean? So like, yeah, what does it take to succeed?
I think back then a few years ago, you have got to like put the, it's not an ego, is it? I think, because I hate doing that as well. I was the same. I'm like, I don't want to be posting about tickets on my story but the people that make the silly money at uni
they
did it and they made stupid money. There's some people that started out doing that at uni who are now like huge and they made it off. When I was at uni, I used to make money off tickets, but it was through, just because people knew that I worked for Cirque. So when they came to the city, it was all cash in hand back then as well, which is mental. Like we used to have to, when we did the tour bus, we'd collect the money. All the reps would come to the bus with they had paper tickets. They'd come with their money. They'd be like, I sold £600 worth of tickets. Here's the cash. And we'd count, we'd look at their like stamp book and make sure they'd done the right amount. But you're wandering around with, when it's a 7-day tour, with like 50, 60 grand in cash.
My goodness. So here's a question from me to you. You're a uni student. You're selling tickets. What's the most that you made in a night?
If you're a uni student, you can make like 2 or 3 grand in a night. Yeah.
I'm going back to uni. I'm selling tickets.
If you're working for like Warehouse, because they used to have a massive rep team. All you need to do is become like, I went in Manchester, my halls was like Owens Park, sort of Oak House, and that
shout
area,
out Owens Park.
That area had like thousands and thousands of students. If you become the go-to person for tickets in that halls, then everyone's texting you. You put your number on a group, like, and they'll hit you up every weekend for tickets for a show.
Yeah,
it's regular income. Definitely.
And wait, bro, we're about to help some uni students. So some uni student is listening to this and they're going, I want to make $2,000 or $3,000 in a night selling tickets. Yeah. How do you become the go-to person?
You've got, because if you do well on the first one, like if you do well on the, it's probably changed a bit post-COVID because before it was all cash paper. Now it's all through ticket platforms, but it kind of can be easier then because you just blast your link out everywhere.
Yeah.
Every Facebook chat, every group chat, all your halls chats, and any sale through that, you're getting paid off instantly.
Yeah.
So
do you think there's some people who like, they do that and then they're like, oh, if you use my link, I'll break you a little something as well.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Maybe your $3,000, maybe give away like 300 of that to other people. Yeah,
they'll definitely work. Like the big one on society is like, if you can convince the rugby social to come out at uni, that's 200 people, 200 tickets sold, isn't it?
And what's the percentage like?
So they know, it varies on what show it is. It'll normally, some people get like £1, some will get like £2, £3 a ticket. There'll be like bonuses for like...
accelerators.
If you sell like 30, you'll get like an extra £50 or it all adds up, and it's sort of like if you can convince a big group, that's like, yeah, it's still
it's at this moment I knew I fucked up. Why did I sell the motherfucking tickets?
Yeah, they often, some of them make, they probably make more money than a promoter sometimes.
Oh my god.
Yeah,
so
but they're so valuable, like they are so valuable, like a good ticket seller, often big DJs will be ticket sellers. That's how that, so I've got a guy in Leeds at the moment who's a first year at uni there. He was like, I want a DJ, but I'll sell you tickets and I'll smash it. He sold like 160 tickets to our last show in Leeds. So because of that, I then gave him a better set of the night. I was like, right, you deserve, I want to accelerate you and push you. So because you sold that many tickets, so that means next time he's going to want to do even better because he wants to get a better set. So it's like rewarding the success, basically. Obviously, he gets all the cash, but he also gets like a really good set at the next show. So... mm-hmm. Yeah, rewarding their sort of success and monitoring it. And sort of, if you see someone that's doing really well, bringing them on board. Because for the festival, we have head reps in each city and they manage the whole city.
Yeah.
So they'll get... for the festival, we do bigger things. It's like £5, £10 a ticket. But obviously, you're not selling 500 festival tickets. You're selling 20 or something. So, but we had some that sold like 300 or something as a city.
Quick
so,
maths, that's £1,500 to £2,000. Yeah.
They're making good money. So... but it's a lot harder selling. It is sales, isn't it? It's like any other sort of.
So basically, the harder you work, the more you put in, the more you can potentially get out.
Yeah, and the more that you become associated with that brand, so the more that we're doing 5 shows a year in your city. So if the first one goes well, people are going to come back every time.
They'll come
for
straight
you.
Back to you
because the tickets, their tickets are cheaper than ours as well. So there's general sale. The rep ticket's normally like £1 cheaper for every release.
Oh, is it?
So it makes sense to go to them as a punter, but also for them it makes sense.
So that's uni students.
Yeah.
What happens, let's say you graduate, so you come to London.
You come to London.
How can you still make money selling tickets?
So in London, less so. But in London, our audience is not students. So we work on like a cycle. So they go to uni, they do freshers.
I know some friends who want to go to an event, man. Give me a little time, man.
So they do the uni cycle. They graduate, they come to London, and then they go to our London events, which are normally that because we can see ticket data, we can see gender splits, we can see age range splits, so we know what age people are and where they're from. We can see return customers. So I know there's people that used to go to uni here and they now live here and they moved to here. So we try and create like a cycle, and we've now added the festival into that. So they go to Fresher's show, they go to Halloween, they go to our day party, and then they go to El Dorado in the summer.
Yeah.
And that's the end cycle. And then because our brand is then like known to them, when they move to London and they go on RA and they see us pop up, they're like, oh, it's a familiar face. I'll go to that. I know what they do. I know it's good. I'll go to their show in London. So it's just about sort of brand identity and building that up to become like a trusted... people will always go to a night out that they trust... even if the acts are like lesser than, like they don't know them as well, as one that's got a big headliner, but it's like an unknown entity.
And for anybody who's looking to kind of start their own, you know, potential festival, music event, how do you build that trust? What do you say the main things are to build the trust?
We could probably be making a lot more money than we do because we put a lot of everything back in. Mm. We try and be like really personal, like we want people to know who we are and the people behind the brand. So every DJ that plays the show, we work with, like in Leeds alone, we'll have 35 DJs on one night. So I try and make the green room not like a really exclusive headline. I'll put the headliners in there. I'll give them their own private room, but I'll say we've got another green room downstairs, which is like up and coming DJs are there and their mates. I try and make it like fun, and I try and chat to everyone. So they know who I am, and they know the brand, and they're not, because lots of big companies will come in. They won't even go to a show. They'll put it all on. They'll sell the tickets, and then they'll be like, right, you do it in house. You sort stage management. You look after the artists. We're not going to come. We've sold out the tickets. We don't care. We all go to the shows, and there's a face behind the brand.
Yeah.
And then the front of house one to make the customers come back is, yeah, we're putting everything into it, like making sure that you have the best performers, making sure you do big confetti shots, getting really good ticket scanners that are going to be nice people. We do stuff like we work with, there was a big spiking issue in just after COVID across the country. So we work with a really good organization called the Egalitarian, which is like a sort of, it's a prevention of sort of sexual assault, but also they do stuff like, we have sort of people working around the club throughout the night that if you ever feel like you're in trouble or need help, you go to them and they'll sort you out. They'll get your taxi home. They'll take you to the medical staff. They'll take you to security.
Yes,
so we try and make the spaces as safe as possible, because creating like safe spaces in the nightlife industry is really important. And it doesn't, there's a lot of brands that don't do that.
Mm.
A lot of venues that don't have the sort of structural, the structure in place to protect people inside the space.
Yeah.
And it's when you're most vulnerable, right? You're intoxicated, especially for young women, it's not a safe environment. So as a promoter and as a venue and as a sort of larger community, we have to do a lot our end to make it as sort of safe for them to, because when you want to go and escape, right? I think that's why people go clubbing, to escape reality, to sort of let loose and be free. So providing a space in which people can do that, if you do that effectively, then they'll come back basically, because it's where they go to like have their fun.
And I'm just thinking, like, you know me, I've always said, like, if I won Euro Millions, I want to make the next Glastonbury, yeah, right? How did you guys go from, you mentioned the fact that you got four main tours. I'm assuming that they started with the uni events,
yeah,
and then they went to something else, and then they went to something, and now El Dorado's come as like part four. What has like that process been? And to anybody who's starting out with like a night, how would you?
It's the natural step. So a lot of big, so Warehouse Projects,
yeah,
did Warehouse and then started Parklife. So,
oh, that's them.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know.
It's the natural progression. We did the tours before I was there, but they started with the tours and they were doing so well. And because it's so immersive and like interactive, it sort of feeds naturally into a festival, because festivals are a bit more like, we wanted to create, it made sense to do the festival. We had an audience, we had a pool of people in every city that loved us. And we had a period of time in the summer where we weren't doing any shows. And we're like, right, what could we do in this time? It makes sense to do a festival.
Okay.
We got approached by a company that owned half the festival with us, which is AEI Music, which is the, they're sort of like the umbrella company that own UKF, the drum and bass label, Drum and Bass Arena, and a few other companies that are in our office with us. They own 50% and we own 50, so it's like a shared ownership. But they brought the expertise in that side, and we brought the sort of fun, the audience and the sort of demographic that they wanted to target. It's the natural step to do a festival. I would never suggest doing a festival first.
Yeah, of course.
It's a lot. Hard festivals are, you don't think about the sides of it. I think I told you off camera about stuff like portaloos. Like trying to source portaloos for a festival is really hard. And like festivals are all competing for like the best toilets and the best showers. The cost of those have gone up like fivefold. And you know, they were $5,000 for, what would have cost you $5,000 for a set of portaloos will now cost you $25,000.
Oh my, why? Just the price of shit has gone up.
I don't want to say the generic line, but it's that one is just, it's just Brexit. Like the it's to do with like trucking in the UK is like, so lots of like truckers left and so the cost of transportation of portaloos and stuff. Also, when COVID happened, lots of the people that owned the portaloos, they went into like, they started doing, providing, don't know why I talk about toilets so much, but they started doing toilets for building sites, and they realized they can make more money dropping off two portaloos for a building site for 6 months than a festival for 3 days.
Yeah.
So like changing, and same with like security teams, they realize they can make more money working on a site, a building site, than they can working on the Gator Festival.
Yeah.
The hours are like better. It's more, you're in a big city, not in a field. It's like the landscape has changed a lot. But,
And talking about like the landscape changing, like you've mentioned some of the things that have happened as a result of COVID.
Yeah.
How did COVID impact Cirque? And yeah, how is the landscape different now to pre-COVID?
Students, it's now starting to end, but we call them like the COVID sort of kids, the ones that were like 16 to 18 during COVID. Like they didn't, when I was 16, I went to house parties. You're underage going into clubs with fake IDs and stuff. That age, they didn't have that. They were sat at home with their parents. So their social skills and their interaction with music and nightlife is, and just and music generally is really different. Like I think going to house parties and breaking into like squat raves and illegal clubs is like a really important part of discovering what you're interested in. So what I was listening to when I was 16 and what I was listening to when I was 18, 19 was drastically different.
Yeah.
Like I was going to like illegal like grime raves and stuff and listening to MCs that I now love. But before that, I was definitely like chart music, age 14, 15. But you need to go into these environments and sort of explore to discover what you want.
Mm.
So what we had then was that in partnership with the birth of like TikTok and stuff, which is very like, short clips. People know songs, but only for like 10 seconds of it.
Yeah.
Their attention span. Everyone's got their phone out for the drop of a big song.
Yeah.
Then it goes out. They're like, all right, let's go. We've got the clip of the famous. So people come in later for nightclubs and they're drunker and they drink and they go home quicker. They're not there for the whole experience. They're there for that song or they're there for that moment.
That's so weird.
Yeah. It's weird.
They go for one song.
Yeah.
And a little clip. And then they bounce.
And they're out. Yeah,
look at yourselves.
And there's other things post-COVID, like the cost of living. As a student, it's so expensive now. Like, so there's things like people don't buy drinks in nightclubs. They binge drink at home. So when they come into a club, they're all absolutely wasted.
Yeah.
Whereas before at uni, shots were like 50p or something, right? So they'd go out.
You used to get quad vod £2 at university. Absolutely ridiculous.
So they'd be like, they would come into the club and then settle and enjoy themselves. Whereas now they're like, when they go out, they're like, how can I make this the most cost-effective experience possible? I'm going to come in as drunk as possible, have fun, but I can't stay too long because I can't afford to get another drink. So I've got, it's really expensive being a student and it's changed the buying patterns. We used to go, as I say, on tour for a week. We don't do shows in the week anymore because students don't go out in the week. They can only go out once a week. They'll go out on a Friday now. Whereas they used to go out every day of the week and we were like the big party and it'd be on a Tuesday. Whereas we don't do the tours now. We do like weekends because the buying patterns have changed completely. But it's starting to stabilize now. So those kids that, the 16 and 17 year olds that were just after COVID are now about to go to uni. So. Yeah. I can see the patterns starting to return.
Okay.
The experience is way better. I speak to DJs about it as well because you'll have big DJs that used to like make the whole crowd go nuts. Like I've had Shy FX come off stage before and be like, what are they doing? They're not dancing. Yeah. The drugs they take are way weird and now they're all like lots of ketamine in nightclubs and it means that everyone's very docile and like there's not as much movement. Laws around COVID really changed the whole landscape.
And like just on that, like the binge drinking and stuff like that, has it also changed like the level of like security and stuff like that and like people getting kicked out and
definitely, and it kind of linked to the spiking. We found lots of young men just had no understanding of the appropriate way to act in a nightclub or in that environment.
Oh my
God. And how to treat women, I think was a big one. So that's why organizations like the one I was talking about are really important to work with now, but also venues are doing more to sort of just educate people on etiquette of like, the etiquette of like raving is a really big thing. And it's something that in like house music specifically, like they do understand it. People were a bit more free to dress how they want and dance how they want. Whereas at uni, it is you need to be a lot more, you're dealing with younger, more vulnerable people. So you have to be very careful about how you protect them. I've had like big MCs on stage have to like stop sets to be like, get that guy out or really? That guy's. Yeah, the boys at like lots of the rugby unis are like just fighting each other. It's classic, right?
Rugby but boys, man.
It's trying to change the mindset of how you act. It's the way you should act anyway. I don't know why it's, but it's alien to lots of the kids that are coming through at uni now. So yeah. Trying to make them just understand the etiquette of, it's not even etiquette of clubbing, it's the etiquette of how you should act anyway in any environment, right?
Just be a decent human.
But when you add alcohol and drugs into it and like the social boundaries are all shifted and you feel like you're, no one knows who you are, you're safer in that, in sort of hidden in a nightclub, lots of people act, I don't want to group everyone into one group. Most people are like amazing when they go out clubbing.
It's just a few.
There's always a few, there's just a few weirdos. So it's about providing, as I say, a safe space where people can go and have fun. And we've found that now as we've added in these aspects, and we'll post about on the day of the show, we'll post like, there will be these people at the venue looking after you. So you're safe. And it does help. We get loads of like love on those stories and people do really thank us after the event. At the festival, it's a massive thing. Protection at festivals. Our festival works really hard to sort of provide a really, one for sort of sexual assaults. We try and have an amazing team on hand, but also drug usage. Like we have testing units at the festival so you can know what you're taking without, so you can go and test your drugs before you take them, which is great, which is something the government are not doing very well to sort of...
Wait. So, I mean, look, we might have to cut this bit, but what? So you can take drugs at festivals?
No, it's illegal. So it's as a way of encouraging, because people are buying stuff they don't know what it is because it's like cheaper, or they might buy it at the festival because they need drugs. There's a big movement at the moment to provide testing units at festivals so people can take them safely, because they're going to take them anyway. I'd rather they're at a festival taking it under the safe sort of, the precautions are being taken to protect them, because it's scary some of the stuff they find. They'll test them and they'll be like, dodgy sort of shit in it. So it's just making sure that it's safe, providing safe spaces. So we have chill out tents at the festival for we've got like a woman's tent this year, which is like a place you can go and chill out if you feel like it's got all female security staff. It's just got big bean bags. They put films on. If you need a break from just like drunk, annoying people at a festival, it's a safe space for them to go and chat to our team, watch a film, relax.
Oh, sick.
Yeah, get their makeup done, hair done by our team, and then they can go back out and party. But it's just about providing little spaces, because it can be intense going clubbing. I find it. And I'm fine, because like, if I get in, I can just go backstage or in the green room. If you're in a nightclub, it can be quiet, and the only real break is to go to smoking area, and then you might have another weird experience. And all it takes is the wrong security guard. If you go and report something to a security guard and he's like, I don't care, it's not my job, or it
breaks your trust.
Yeah, breaks your trust. So it's about, just making it, building up the loyalty, as I say, is all through little, it's tiny little things, but it all comes together to like build a
report. I hear that. So just going back to what we were saying about like the impact of COVID, the increase in prices, what did you guys do to kind of navigate that period? Because I know you've mentioned the fact that you stopped doing shows in the week.
Yeah.
Did that mean like an impact on the business financially then?
Yeah, massively. We kind of decided, in all honesty, that we had to take the cut ourselves or take the brunt. So we reduced all of our salaries are all done on... Like, we got base rates, but it's all commission-based, basically. Okay. So when the shows are doing well, we all get paid really well, but when they're not, we don't. So what we started doing was sort of looking at ways to make income outside of our traditional nightclub. So we do like brand activations, as I said. So we'll get approached by Jack Daniels and they'll be like, we want you to come up with a concept for us that we've got 50 grand, we want to target students and get them all drinking Jack Daniels. We'd do some like research, we'd put an activation up in a city, we'd take over a nightclub, get a big DJ in, it's a free party, free drinks.
Oh, sick.
Yeah, all sponsored by them. They get free shots of Jack Daniels, a bottle to take home, merchandise, posters. And then now what that means is then for the next year in halls, Jack Daniels is everywhere. Every student's got it on their wall. They've got like hats, like they wear like t-shirts to bed that are like sponsored by them. It's like really subtle ways of breaking into that market. So we looked at ways, we do stuff like that. We also moved into bookings for like bigger. So we do all the bookings for Yacht Week, which is like sort of a touring They go to Croatia every summer for a week with your mates. It's like 30 boats and there's seven.
First week of August?
Every week.
We do it. Every week? Yeah, yeah. Oh, blood. Yeah, okay.
Oh, shit. Yeah, so it's 16 weeks and we do every. Blood, we book the act, the DJs for every single week.
Oh, wow. And then you take a booking fee.
Yeah. It's an easy sell because if you're like to love a coming DJ, do you want to go live on a yacht for a week?
Yeah, yeah.
We also do, that's in the summer, we also do Wasteland Ski, which is the university ski group. So we book all the talent for every ski trip, and there's so many. So there's my cousins are out there pretty much once every 2 weeks at the moment. They go out for like 3 days. They'll DJ to like 2,000 Bristol students, come back. So we book all of that. So it's finding fillers so that we didn't want to have to affect the student audience. Can't in London. We our party's still all sold really well. It didn't really take any effect. We're actually doing more now. They're all selling so well. Because the London audience hasn't been affected as much. Our audience is normally the unis we go to, the students that end up graduating and come to London, they're quite wealthy normally. Mm-hmm. You can tell which cities struggle and which don't. Like Bristol kids have always got money. Our parties always sell out. But there are other cities. So if we can make it more affordable, we've tried to. Because we know long term, it's just about staying alive, basically. And there's lots of brands and lots of venues that are just closing down.
Oh, really?
Nightclubs are completely, all shutting down at the moment.
Are they?
Yeah, the biggest club in Bournemouth shut down like yesterday.
What was the name of that?
Halo.
Oh, damn.
Heaven nightclub in London is about to shut.
Oh, my God.
There's loads of big clubs shutting down.
And is that just because they just don't get the capacity anymore?
Capacity spends when people are in the nightclub are dropping. Rent fees, electricity is a massive one, obviously, energy. The cost of everything's gone up, right? So the margins are being squeezed.
And like on that talk of margins, right? Yeah. You know, you've mentioned the fact that you're doing all of this other stuff to supplement the income. As like when you're putting on an event, where do the margins come from?
We have sliding scales with lots of venues. So for New Year's Eve, for example, we do a show at Troxy, which is not too far from here. And the higher fee itself is like close to £20,000 for New Year's Eve, which is mental.
Yeah.
But that's a sliding scale. So the bar spends throughout the night. I think last year we took £76,000 on the bar, or the venue did. And because we broke £70,000, that higher fee slid all the way down to like £5,000.
Oh, sick.
So it's all about like, it's getting better. Renegotiating with venues is a big one. We've had to go in and be like, look, we're not making the money, neither are you. We need to like make this work better for us. If the show sells out, we'll both eat and we'll both do well. But if it's not, we need to look at ways to cut it and ways to like make it more affordable for students. Mm-hmm. So a big one is also bringing brands in. So lots of our tours are sponsored. We'll do stuff like, we'll bring in like a vaping company to do like, all they'll want is to have a stand in the smoking area, mm-hmm. but they'll pay us like £500 for that show just to stand there.
Yeah, little things
like that allow us to sort of not put the burden on the students or not put it on the punters, but it's a changing game and we're always looking for ways to sort of ways to make more money within the same market.
Take the money off the right people.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, off the big wigs.
I always say this, it's not like there isn't a cost of living crisis for everyone.
There's
some big people that just don't. Lots of brands have just been bought out this last 2 years. Big companies coming in, just buying the whole thing. Here's $250,000. We own this now.
Yeah.
And no one knows it's happened, but they're behind the scenes. So that, companies like Live Nation, which own most of the festivals, they'll come in and buy a festival just to kill it off.
Really?
Competition. So they'll go, here's £1 million. We own this now. And then they'll just cancel.
Have they tried to come to you guys?
Not Live Nation. No, luckily not. But we have been approached by quite a few people. But
you don't want to sell?
Nah. Yeah. we're part of the Association of Independent Festivals. I'm on like the board of the junior board, basically, because it's like the young person's one. I'm probably getting a bit too old for it now. And then the main one, which is headed up by the guy that the CEO is the guy that runs Notting Hill Carnival, which is amazing. But it's got like all the heads of all these independent festivals. And we worked. So we're at the moment lobbying the government to try and cut the VAT to 5%. Mm-hmm. Which would save on like average, if we look at like El Dorado, it would save us £250,000.
Oh my goodness.
So it's massive. It's actually like a game changer. But the VAT, because they did a VAT cut just after COVID, and that saved a lot of places, but it's not there anymore. But looking for ways to like protect their industry is a massive one, because these big companies like Live Nation and stuff, they just have such ownership of the industry. They can get better fees. There's lots of weird things, like some promoters that work in our sector, they're part owned by booking agencies that have massive artists, which means they can get the artists that we want for half the fee.
Yeah.
So then their spend on a night is like way less than ours. And if they have to cancel, they're not paying that artist any money because they own the artists. They're like, cool, you're not getting paid this week. Whereas if we cancel, we've got to pay $2,500 anyway. So there are people in the industry for the wrong reasons, but there are also lots of people in it for the right reasons, which is why like things like the Association of Independent Festivals and the Nighttime Economy Association and stuff like that are really important for protecting, because there's independent venues are like really, really important.
Yeah.
And they're suffering at the moment massively.
Bloody hell, man. Well, thanks for shining a light on it, man. And yeah, hopefully, you know, we navigate through this time. And I hope that you guys continue to thrive. You know, just kind of continuing through, it sounds like you do a lot. A couple of questions I had. One, with all the artists that you book, like, what does that process look like? Is it because you're so established now, it's easy to reach out to agents and to artists? Do they come to you?
Yeah, I don't deal direct. We have a guy called, or one of my directors is called Jack. He does all our bookings. But because they're like 10 years deep now, he's got relations with, you realise is there's only really like 4 or 5 agencies that own every artist in the whole country. So he knows them all personally. Like, they play football in our five-a-side. They're in our, like, fantasy football leagues. We're friends with them. We meet them. It's obviously a working business relationship. We're friends until you owe them money or something, and then you're not friends. So it starts off with, we plan, like, a year in advance. So we're in the talks now for New Year's Eve. We're booking out for that. It's like March.
Yeah, yeah.
But you have to put, we started off with a list of like 20. We're now down to like 4 that are left. The others are like, they'll be like, no, I'm in Australia. I'm not taking, I'll only play with this artist, but that would make the lineup like $50,000. We're like, we can't do that. So you've got to book real, real far in advance. And the way that artists post COVID has also changed. So lots of them, which is a good thing, but not for us, is lots of them take the January to March period off for like mental health purposes, because they're in, like, they're doing like 5 shows a week, every single week across the Europe. So they're flying constantly. They need time to like, one, make new music and two, just to like have a bit of a break. Also lots of them, the touring cycle. So we're now changing ours. We'll be going, so the January to March bit, we'll be doing like Australia, New Zealand and Asia is the idea. Because in the UK, it's just like a bleak time at the moment, right? Yeah. No one's got any money. It's post-Christmas. It's cold. It's wet. So the UK clubbing season is like September to December. So we'll still do that. But we're looking at ways of like branching out. So I'd like to do like Australia through to like Bali, that kind of side of the world in January.
Do you have the connects to set that up?
Yeah, now we do. Because lots of artists are doing it anyway. So we know that, we just ask them who they're. There are companies like us that's in Australia that like facilitate tours. Yeah. So we'd approach them and say, we want to bring this artist out. And luckily our old head of production has just moved to Australia. So he'll be on the ground. He's going to work in the venues there. So he'll have like insight hopefully by next year.
Sick.
But yeah, you've got to book artists. There's a lot of competition. Your artists get blocked in certain cities like Manchester. The guy that runs the Warehouse Project basically has ownership of any. If you're like, I want to book Conductor in Manchester, his manager will have to ask the head of Warehouse Project.
Okay.
He's like, can we, and he'll say like, no, I don't want him playing for any other shows. Even if he doesn't own him, it's just because he has such ownership of the city and is the head like biggest venue owner. Same in Nottingham, they'll block artists. You have like normally like a 30-kilometer radius over a 6-month period where no one they can't play in any other city. So if you book someone in Nottingham, they can't play in Leicester in the next 6 months because you've put them in Nottingham.
Wow.
But we don't have that. So we have that on some acts, but it's normally just the big guys that have the ownership of that and they can choose who plays where. So we had acts for the festival that were playing Leeds Festival and they blocked. So like Over Mono's playing Leeds. We wanted them for El Dorado. El Dorado's near Wales and they blocked it. They were like, no, it's in the same country, the same month. We don't want to, you can't do that. So it's all about, it's a lot of like, it's a lot of personal relationships, and there are certain guys that we know better and we can work better with, and there are ones that have like their fingers in other pies, so they'll want to work with other promoters more than us.
Yeah.
It's just like a minefield navigating it.
this is blowing like my mind. Like, you don't realize what goes into putting on like an insane event. Like, along the same lines, are there any other like misconceptions about events that like you just hear people like say, and they're like, oh, that's just that's
the big one for me is that I just think that the backstage is so it's not glamorous at all. Everyone makes out like it's just popping bottles and going on stage and like hanging out with like whoever you want. They bring all their like, it's like big DJs bringing like girls backstage. It's just, it's such like a, it's normally just like four people sat in there pretty stressed because they're about to go DJ.
Okay.
Like, normally tired because they've done two shows in a row, or they're like, some artists are doing four shows a day, so like they'll do like a two daytime ones, they'll come like, they'll play like 12 to 1, drive to another city, play like 1:30 to 2:30, and then close somewhere else at 4 to 5. They're all like, so I think that unglamorizing like what backstage life is like is quite a big one. Yeah. Also, the touring side of it is like, it's great, but it's like, it is like quite tiring for me personally. Like, I love going, it's great getting to like fly to the Alps, but I've had times where I'm like, oh, I just don't want to go skiing. If I say that to like one of our friends, like some of your friends that love skiing, he's just like, no, what, how can you not want to go skiing? It's all paid for. I'm like, because what you don't realize is to get to that ski set, you've got to do a 4-hour drive through the mountains. You're there for, I've had times where we're there for like 2 hours. And then a 4-hour drive back. So you're traveling for a day for 2 hours set, and then going, it's a lot of, I think you see the bit on camera, you don't see the behind the scenes bit.
Yeah. It's a bit like a picture of the iceberg, right? Yeah. Like, you see the iceberg peeking out, but you don't everything below that goes
and
into
and things
it.
Like the shows that don't do well, they like, it can come down to such tiny things like weather. If it's raining, that mucks you up. If it's, if another headliner announces a show on the same day as you in the same city, you're not going to sell. It's like, there's little things that you can't, you can prepare for months and have amazing acts, a massive promo plan, like amazing videos all ready to go. You can launch it and then you're like, oh, same day. Oh, someone like, just like Fred again's doing the show the same night as you. Like, great. So we're not going to sell any tickets. And you've got to rearrange. So it's a lot of like highs and lows. Like, when shows sell out, it's the best thing in the world. But when they don't, it is
and on that, like, how do you like deal with the lows?
I think the bigger picture, that's why I quite like having so many shows a year, because I know that
you can rebound.
Some are going to be good, and it does sort of, yeah, taking the, yeah, just, and making sure you enjoy like the good moments.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're like incredible. But like looking, yeah, just making sure you take it as it comes, because it also non-work, realizing it's just a job. It's really easy to think this is like everything.
Yeah.
When you're, it's so 24/7. I'll get a text from like, it might be like a random DJ saying, can I get that invoice paid? It'll be at like 9 p.m. on a Saturday. So little things like getting a work phone and having a work, I think sure we'll touch on it, but like the work life balance is so, yeah, like finding, yeah, just making sure you do see it as a job, because it's quite hard to do that sometimes and step back.
Mm.
But then when you do that, it's a bit easier.
It's a bit like compartmentalizing, right?
Yeah,
I get that. And like kind of a similar question, what would you say the most rewarding part of being head of marketing and events is?
I think it's the moments, that it's just those like those moments when it like everything clicks, it all like aligns. So we had one at like New Year's Eve this year, we had Sammy Virgie and Flo Dan. And that was off the back of their massive summer. They did that massive song called Shellaverse. But it was when Badadam was like charting with Flo Dan. And I think Sammy Virgie had just done 4 shows on New Year's Eve. And we were the last one. He was playing at like 2:30 a.m. Flo Dan was on stage and I rushed him out of the taxi because he'd driven from Warehouse Project from Manchester to London for the show. And I like rushed him on stage. He literally came out onto the massive, it's a massive theatre, sold out, like 3,000 people. And he came out and like hugged Flo Dan on stage or something. And it's like, and the whole crowd going nuts, and then they drop their song. And it's just like, those moments. So like New Year's Eve is always a big one because it's like the end of the touring season for us. So like the countdown, I'm normally with, the great thing is I work with my cousins. So whenever we do the, all these big occasions like New Year's Eve, I'm normally with all my family. So like my mum will come, their parents will come, all the artists' parents come normally, the whole especially when it's London, they'll all come and we always do London. So those moments, like when you've got a sold out, we had the biggest event in London on New Year's Eve in the whole country, I think, technically. It sold out in November. So, and tickets were like going for like 100 quid on the day or something stupid. So the moment when it all like clicks, there's confetti shots, it's Happy New Year, you're like with your family. It's, yeah, just like those moments, like that when the energy is crazy. That's what the best sense of it.
And I always like to ask the inverse. What would you say the most stressful part of being?
The unpredictability, like especially at the moment, everyone loves like 360 booths, like boiler room style booths, which are like great, but there's nothing to stop some drunk kid lobbing his beer on the decks. And like there's nothing you can do when the decks, like you can replace them, but there's like 10 minutes of no music. So moments like that, or another one, headliners not coming, missing their flight, you've got to go out on stage and tell everyone he's not here.
Does that mean you've got to do some choir singing when that happens?
it's a tough one. We've had, and it's often not their fault. We've had really sad ones where it's been like, I don't know, like one of them was like, my brother's just died, I can't make it tonight, time off. Whoa. A big act. And what often happens is great with the dance music scene is that they'll have people that step in. So we've had ones where big acts have cancelled. Shy FX, will call and say, I'll do it. I'll step in and do the set for him. And so you get a great cover and it's an amazing show. But it's like there is a real sense of community in the music industry. So it's the things you can't predict. The decks breaking, the door. Everyone, like if you have a show of 3,000 people, there's ways to sort of counter this now. You can do time tiered tickets, but everyone comes at like 12:30, exact same time. And no matter how many scanners you've got or security, if there's 3,000 people in a queue and it starts to rain, it's absolute chaos. Like there's like stampeding, there's people getting squashed, they're angry, it ruins the night before it starts. So the unpredictability is the big thing that's hard to deal with.
I hear that. And it sounds like you do a lot. There's a lot of traveling. Do you have any productivity hacks?
Mine is just like stepping out of the, like where we work is like really, it's like on the canal, literally just down the road. Just stepping out for when a show's like, when you're like mid-tour, so you're like, every 10 minutes you're like checking the ticket counts, you're ringing reps, and it can get quite intense but I think about a year ago I realised that there's no, like looking at the ticket count every 10 minutes is not going to, if you look at it every day, it's the same as looking at every 10 minutes. It's not going to, watching it go up by like 10 tickets every few minutes, it's just like, it's not
the number's
going to
be the number. You can't impact it.
So just stepping back, I go get, we've got like a communal workspace down the road, which is also owned by the partner company. I'll just say to like someone else, let's go get a coffee. Like, stepping back and then stepping back in. Same way when you used to like revise in school, they're always like, make sure you take breaks every 30 minutes. Like your brain will function better when you step out and step back in. And also just trying to like look at the other thing I do is try and keep myself like engaged in always doing like new stuff. So I've started a few new parties. You came to my recent one.
Yeah, I did stuff like that.
Sort of more like, that's so exciting for me, like doing fun new concepts that no one's ever done before. And all that, like that's a way of making me like fall back in like, cause it's great. You fall in and out of like love, like nightlife and clubbing. So when you throw new concepts and new parties and they go well, that's like really exciting. So doing stuff like that is sort of,
yeah, bro, you mentioned the event that you put on. It was sick. Do you have anything else lined up?
Yeah, we're doing another one soon. So it's called Behave. It's more like, I don't know how to describe it. It's like an immersive, we had like paid actors. It was in like a townhouse in Old Street. It had like dress up, amazing costumes, drag performers. The idea behind it is to sort of take sort of non-formal spaces like houses, country manors, weird spaces that aren't normally conventionally used for events and throw parties there.
Lots of secret rooms.
Yeah, lots of secret rooms. All kind of secret set. So the last time we had O'Flynn come and play. I want to try and get like Barry Cantor at the next one, but people like Bonobo, yeah, trying to get people in basically that wouldn't, without, but unannounced. So I want it to kind of be a thing where people come because they know it's going to be good and they don't, not because they know who's playing or what it is. So sick. The secretive aspect. We are, yeah, we're doing one on the end of April in the same venue, so 25 Paul Street, which is sort of in Old Street. But we've got some really exciting ones coming up, sort of a big country, bit it's a weird way to describe it, kind of like a bit Saltburn-y. big country manners, unannounced DJs, interactive. Man on the dance floor. Exactly, yeah. I want to get her down for a show. That'd be sick.
Yeah.
But yeah, so keep
there's some things coming out. Yeah. I'm about to start making some money. Give me my link. All right, sick, bro. And yeah. We kind of touched upon it. Like, do you think you have a good work-life balance?
I do now, better now, because of the fact I've gone down to like a kind of informal four-day week. Mm-hmm. I don't drink at shows, I think is a big one. But it's, yeah, it is. Some people do not. There are big, big artists that have very unhealthy relationships with music. And honestly, some of the huge ones, I'm like, I don't know how you're still alive in terms of the drug usage, the hours they do, the travel. It's very hard. And I think lots of people, I mean, if you look at like Avicii, who died a few years ago, that was, it's purely, he died because of his team were touring him too hard. Calvin Harris had a heart attack at what, 27 or something?
Oh my God.
It's just because of over, it's just like, you have to find a balance because they say like those hours, working nightlife does affect your life. You're more prone to heart attacks, sort of illness. It's not healthy. So finding the balance. So that's why lots of artists now just do, they'll just have a ginger shot on their rider and a bottle of water, not like two bottles of Patron. Because it's easy when you know you can get it all for free, just take everything you want.
Yeah.
But honestly, the next day, and also the high you get from a show is, you don't need to be drunk to enjoy a show. Like, the bit I find really annoying is post-show, like, it takes me like 2 hours to come down off the adrenaline of a show, like, even when I'm not drinking. Just like, you're in bed, like, and because you're home so late, you need to go to bed because you've got to check out at 11 and get back to London.
Yeah.
But you're sat in bed, just like, the adrenaline and just that like, energy is enough alone. Both my cousins that are like big DJs, they're both teetotal now. And they both, like, honest discussions with them, they enjoy it more. Like, the interactions you have with the crowd, the way you DJ, you're better at DJing, so, right?
But so, do you feel like, I hear that, and it's great that your cousin's a Tito, it's great that you don't drink anymore. Do you feel like it's kind of one of those things, it's like a rite of passage though, like, you've got to like, it enjoy you, it, go for it, and then realise it's not for you.
I don't want to say it on camera, but like, I always say the most important, this is the other thing with COVID that I think lots of kids, that COVID generation miss. If you drop a pill at a festival and just wander off into the distance, that's when you're going to discover what you like and what you'll end up in some random tiny tent at a festival listening to like side trance or something. And you're like,
I don't condone this, by the way. This is, his thoughts are his own.
This is what I'm suggesting. Right? It's definitely a rite of passage. I remember like my watching Arctic Monkeys at Glastonbury years and years ago. And like, it was when I was like very, very drunk and like, it's just like the best moments of your life. Sort of those highs and the feelings you get. So yeah, definitely. I don't want people to stop drinking because it makes the crowd much more exciting for the shows when they're like going for it and they're enjoying it. But it's just like finding a balance. I think when you work in nightlife, as you say, like it's so the glamorized side of it, but you have to find a balance. So yeah. I try and like drink at festivals. I go, the way our festival works is we're there for 2 weeks before. Building, literally like painting buildings, doing everything. As soon as the door opens, everyone that works on the pre-build is free. They go and enjoy it.
Wow.
We're not, as soon as it's live, I'm not doing anything. None of us are. It because it's only 3 days a year, we have to do that. Otherwise, it wouldn't be worth it. And when the fireworks are going off on the Sunday and you've got like, I don't know, who had like Sister Sledge and Kate, all these huge famous bands playing with fireworks and you're surrounded and there's 12,000 people there. That's another moment where you're like, right, this is all worth it. It's amazing. That sort of stuff is, but yeah, it's finding the balance, right?
Yeah.
You've got to find reasons to enjoy it but also not enjoy it too much.
Ben, I hear that. This has been like a sick conversation. Just before we get into the quick fire round, like, where do you see yourself in the next 5 and 10 years?
I'm starting to, I really want to go into artist management. My cousin is got like a new alias at the moment and it's doing really well. He's got some tracks that have just been signed to like a really big label. So he wants, because I've worked with him for years and I know what he's like and what he wants me to kind of be his manager as he sort of gets bigger. So artist management's a big one. I'd love to own a music venue or a space. I think what I'd love to own like a pub, but it's not just a pub. It's like a multi-venue, has like a venue space, a restaurant. One of my best friends is like a very high-end chef in Michelin restaurants. And another one is like worked in pubs his whole life and is like the best pub barman I've ever met. So I'd love to sort of, our dream is to open like a space.
It's like the Bear meets the Queen Vic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And there's a bit of raving.
I want some of the people coming in, they're like, what is this? Like,
yeah.
You go to a pub, the pub shuts, you go to a nightclub, and then you're like at a restaurant eating dinner. Like, I love, like, there's spaces like that in London. So I'd love to get some experience. I'd probably see myself before that going into working at a venue. I'd love to work at Coco in London. It's like my favourite place.
Okay.
So I'm trying to get an in there at the moment. My mate works there. So I'm always like, if there's ever any jobs, let me know.
Even with all the stuff you're doing with Cert, you're still hustling, networking.
It's all evolving. I can't be up this late every
day. I hear it. And the other thing just to touch upon, like we were talking off camera, you mentioned the fact that like you're writing a curriculum
I'm trying to, there's a massive issue in this industry with diversity and inclusion. It's very like whitewashed and there's a lot of, I mean, I say this as someone that is like a middle-class white guy. There's a lot of the same people.
Yeah.
But being like where like I'm from here, I'm from Hackney. So a lot of my mates that grew up are not from the same background as me. And there's a real lack of understanding in music that like the music that everyone goes clubbing to and enjoys is normally derived from black and South Asian sort of genres of music, whether that's garage and sort of the involvement of sort of Punjabi background origins in that, or like the black involvement in house music is literally fundamental. It's the only reason it exists. But then you get into the scenes and everyone that owns the venues is wealthy white guys and everyone that sort of has the power and dominates the sector. It's changing, but there's a lot of, I want to sort of diversify and improve the back end bits, like the arts liaison, the stage managers, the lighting techs. I want to make it accessible for everyone, basically. So I am, in the process of trying to come up with it's going to be called like a live events degree,
diploma.
Is the idea,
yeah, degree,
or like diploma, yeah.
Yeah.
So I've helped at the moment one of my mates called Robson Carter Brown, who worked at SBTV. After Jamal died, he set up like an events internship thing that we've just launched at the Roundhouse, which is they'll take two people on every year that go and work at the Roundhouse for 6 weeks, and then they work through Greenpeace. They get taken on the site at Glastonbury, so it's like a live events internship at Glastonbury.
Wow.
So we're looking to grow that. That's two at the moment, but hopefully up to like as many as we can. Basically,
we're going
to
link that. We're going to link that.
But that's only an internship. It's like a 3-month program. Talking to people at my office, I want to make it a full, I work in such a unique office where I see like from music publishing all the way through to like front of house events, every single aspect of like this industry. And I want to create some sort of diploma or qualification that it basically people come in and when they leave, they're not just, it's very easy to be experienced in this sector, but not have anything to show for it.
Mm.
There are guys that I know that are like amazingly experienced, but when they go and apply for another job, all they can put on their CV is that they've worked at, I don't know, Printworks, but they can't put that they know how to, like their advertisement skills or like how how to like work in marketing or sales or their personable skills. So yeah, kind of like creating something that's written that shows the work that goes into
everything that's done.
Because it's quite forgotten. And also while doing that, trying to get the people that are doing that to be a bit more, to make it more inclusive, basically. Because the space should be open for everyone, basically.
I love it. Ben, this has been sick. Let me draw for the phone now because Yeah, it's time for the quick fire round. You ready?
Yeah, go on.
All right, bro. Money or happiness?
Happiness, probably.
Probably, you know.
Yeah,
if you could,
money comes from, if you're happy and in the right mindset, you can probably make money.
That's true.
That's the other way it can be, go the other way it can go wrong.
That's a fact. If you could only listen to one music genre for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Probably Afrobeat. I mean, I love, like, it comes in waves, but like Burna Boy is like my top artist.
Every year
for like 4 or 5 years. So that's my way of switching off. So yeah, Afrobeat.
Afrobeat's sick. Favorite venue?
There's Red Rock in America, which is amazing. But in the UK, it probably is Beaverworks up in Leeds because I love like multi room print works and stuff are great. But I like going into like squat ravey kind of space. So, Beaverworks in Leeds.
Okay, sick. Would you rather organise multiple smaller events throughout the year or one large flagship event annually?
I mean, we do both, but I'd say probably multiple.
Okay.
Because of that highs and lows thing I was saying.
Yeah, sick. Favourite book?
Favourite book. There's a really good one by DJ Target at the moment called Grime Kids, which is all about like the birth of grime music and how it sort of developed out of Bow.
Okay.
That's a really good one.
Right. Sick. Would you rather travel to the past or future?
Past, but not that far back. I'd probably go to like 1980s.
Okay.
Hacienda, that club, and then the up to like 2000s.
Okay, sick. I thought you was going to be like last year so I could rebook all the artists there.
Go back to 2019 and like sort out COVID.
Would you rather host your own events in a traditional venue or in an unconventional, unique location to create memorable experiences?
Unconventional. That's what that one that you went to recently is like, that's what I tried to do there. But yeah, like, it's so much more fun. It's a lot more boundaries around it, but yeah, definitely.
Yeah, mate, it was a sick event. Are you listening to any good podcasts?
You know what? I'm not really into, when I listen to podcasts, it's all like the trip, it's like the Shits and Gigs ones like Chunks and Philly. Like, it's just like, and it's switch off. Okay. I don't really use them if they're informative. I'm more just like music constantly because I'm trying to find new people. But yeah.
Bro, that's fair. Who has it easier, men or women?
In my sector or just in life?
Just in life.
Probably men. Definitely men.
Good.
And in my sector especially. Yeah.
Okay. 100%. And then final question. Who would be your dream headline act?
Someone just mental, like Sean Paul or something.
Sean Paul. I can't believe that's what you said. Out of nowhere. We went from Burna to Sean Paul out of nowhere.
On the stage. Imagine that. In a nightclub or something. It'd be mental.
All right. Sick. Love that. Ben, this has been such a sick conversation. We do have a closing tradition. Knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your younger self? And would you still be doing the same thing?
I probably would have taken a bit more risks, I think. There's people that just ask the questions and try and get as much experience. I think lots of things I took the safe route and like stepped back. But there's people where I was like, I should manage you. It'd be amazing. And now they're doing really well. And I'm like, I wish I'd done that or taken that leap. So ask the questions, get stuck in a bit more and don't play it safe. Obviously like respect boundaries and stuff, but push yourself to sort of jump out of the comfort zone.
Sick. And I assume you'd still be doing the same thing.
Yeah, I'd like to go into, I wish I'd gone more into live music, but that's something I can do when I'm older.
Okay, yeah.
You
still got time. You're still young, boy. You're still young.
That's the plan, but yeah.
All right.
Definitely the same.
Ben, this has been such a sick conversation. Do you want to plug any socials? Where can people find you? Where can people find Cirque?
I think follow. So Cirque du Soleil, it's spelt, it will come up if you type in Cirque, I reckon.
Yeah.
And then El Dorado Festival is the big one, which is in July. July the 11th to the 14th.
We'll link some tickets. Are they on sale yet?
On sale now.
Sale. We're going to link some tickets. Use code BIO10 because I'm about to start getting my £5 and £10. You get me? Now, Ben, this has been such a sick conversation. I feel like I actually had a music manager on a couple of weeks back. I've listened to you. I'm ready. We're hearing all the stuff about Diddy. There's about to be a power vacuum. Diddy, move aside. Yeah, move aside. I'm coming. No, this has been sick, guys. If you got to this point, you know what to do. Like, share, subscribe, comment. Let us know who you want to hear from next. This has been another episode of What My Best Friend Does. If you didn't know, now you know. Over and out.